From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sonny Rollins has a new 2-CD retrospective of his 25 years with Milestone Records. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Rollins, the jazz musician some critics consider the greatest living improviser. A new Star Trek movie opened today. We'll hear about the first Star Trek TV series from Captain Kirk himself, William Shatner. Jeff Bridges is co-starring with Barbara Streisand in The Mirror Has Two Faces. He'll talk with us about growing up in an acting family with father Lloyd Bridges and brother Beau Bridges. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the remake of In Cold Blood, and John Powers reviews the new movie Breaking the Waves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The President and Mrs. Clinton are spending the next couple of days in Port Douglas, Australia. It's home to some of the most exotic plant and animal life in the world. It's also the site of the Great Barrier Reef. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The President used the Great Barrier Reef as a background for an environmental speech, calling for greater international commitments to protecting fragile ecosystems. Before the speech, he and Mrs. Clinton strolled through the rainforest habitat, where they were surrounded by kangaroos, wallabies, and koalas. The highlight of the visit undoubtedly was a 9-month-old koala named Chelsea. The President carried the furry creature in his arms as it clung to a much larger stuffed koala. The Clintons will spend the rest of this day enjoying the luxury Sheraton Mirage Resort on the beaches of the Coral Sea. Tomorrow, they board Air Force One for a flight to Manila and more serious business, Pacific Rim Trade. The President will join 17 other regional leaders for the annual APEC conference. I'm Vicki O'Hara in Port Douglas.
The wife of former Congressman Mel Reynolds has agreed to plead guilty to federal election violations and cooperate in the prosecution of her husband on financial fraud charges. The lawyer for Marisol Reynolds says she will testify if needed against her husband. In exchange, she will receive probation. The former Democratic congressman is already imprisoned on state convictions for having sex with an underage campaign worker and trying to sabotage the investigation of the case. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has released a plan to reduce airbag fatalities in vehicles. The devices are credited with saving more than 1,100 lives, but they're also blamed for the deaths of at least 30 children, many of whom who were riding in the front seats of cars or weren't properly buckled in. The NHTSA will require automakers to paste brightly colored stickers in new vehicles, warning people about how dangerous airbags can be to kids and small adults. The NHTSA administrator, Ricardo Martinez, says it won't solve everything, but it is a solid beginning.
There is no silver bullet. There's no one solution that solves all of the particulars of this complex problem. But solving the problems while preserving the benefits was the fundamental maxim that guided all of our deliberations to make current and future airbags safer.
The agency is also proposing letting automakers install airbags that deploy with less force, and there's a call for smart airbags. Those devices would be able to sense the position or weight of a passenger and adjust bag deployment to provide the best protection. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 26 points at 6,444. The NASDAQ is up 12 points at 1,270. This is NPR. Snow and ice storms in the Pacific Northwest are to blame for another death. Authorities say a utility worker died last night when he accidentally touched a live power line that had been downed in Spokane. The death toll from the regional storm stands at 11. Tens of thousands of people are still without power in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. The National Guard's been called in to help in Washington with the power problems, but officials say it could take another 3 days before electricity is restored to everyone. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and Lockheed Martin, formerly known as Martin Marietta, have agreed to settle one of the largest age discrimination lawsuits ever filed. NPR's Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
Between 1990 and 1994, Martin Marietta's Denver Astronautics Division laid off some 3,100 workers. Afterwards, the EEOC charged the company singled out workers 40 years of age and older. To settle the lawsuit, the company has agreed to pay $13 million to about 2,000 former employees and to rehire 450 of those. But the agreement does not settle the dispute. Greg McReynolds represents a group of former Martin workers who filed a private age discrimination lawsuit against the company.
We have a tremendous amount of evidence, most of it internal, which I'm not at liberty to tell you about because of the confidentiality, but the evidence is very strong of a pattern and practice of discrimination.
In a prepared statement, Lockheed Martin denies the company did anything wrong. I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Doctors for Mother Teresa say the 86-year-old nun is improving considerably after being hospitalized again for an irregular heartbeat. This is the fourth time she's been in the Calcutta hospital this year. She's now in stable condition. The Nobel Peace Prize winner has been in the hospital to be treated for malaria, a chest infection, and two falls. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Rhino Records, producers of Stan Freberg's comic view of history, The United States of America, Volume 1, The Early Years, and the new Volume 2, The Middle Years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new Sonny Rollins double CD called Silver City that's a retrospective of his 25 years with Milestone. Earlier this year, Milestone released a new CD called Sonny Rollins Plus 3. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1994 interview with Rollins, a musician who may have no living equal. Rollins started recording in the late 40s, and early in his career played with the musicians now in the pantheon of modern jazz, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Miles Davis, Max Roach, and Clifford Brown. Jazz critic Francis Davis describes Rollins as the quintessential jazz man, heroic, inspired, mythical, obsessed. Davis says, Rollins is the greatest living jazz improviser. He may be the greatest virtuoso that jazz has ever produced. Let's begin with Rollins soloing on Skylark. This 1972 recording is featured on the new Milestone retrospective.
Said to me one time that if it wasn't for music, life wouldn't be worthwhile living. I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing what he said, but you know, if I don't play for a little while, I get physically sick. You know, if I don't play my horn for a while, for a few days or whatever, I actually begin to get sick, and I wonder, well, gee, what's the matter with me? Then I realize, well, I haven't played my horn for a few days.
When you're performing and you're improvising, are you thinking?
Well, no, not really. No, I don't think. That's why I really practice and I keep these exercises and so on, because when I'm actually on the stage and performing, the optimum condition is not to think. I just want the music to play itself. I don't want to have to think about it. If I have to think about what I'm doing, then the moment is already gone, you know?
Are you analyzing what you're playing as you're doing it, saying, oh, this is good, or oh, I don't like this, I've got to find something that's working better?
When I'm really playing at my best, I can hear what I'm doing, but after it's done, but I can't hear it while I'm doing it. And there are some occasions when I really can stand back mentally and sort of listen to myself play. The music just plays itself. I'm just a person standing there with the, moving my fingers and so on. And there's certain times when actually it's an out-of-body experience, so to speak.
What do you do when you practice now? I mean, you're a brilliant player. You're a veteran player. I think a lot of people of your stature would probably just perform and not exactly practice anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you play a reed instrument, and it might be true with other instruments as well, but when you play a reed instrument, you have to deal with your embouchure, which is the position of your lips around your teeth and the instrument and the mouthpiece of the instrument. And this has to form a sort of a cushion. And if you don't play for a while, what will happen is that your lips would bleed when you play. And even split, your lip might split. It's happened to me when I've had to lay off for a period of time. For other things, I'm not certain. I practice a lot of things, but I read once where my friend Max Roach said that a lot of musicians shouldn't really practice. Practicing is cheating after you reach a certain point. So that may be right, but in the case of just keeping my embouchure from bleeding and my lip from splitting, I like to play a certain amount every day, you know.
Sonny Rollins is my guest. One of the things that I love about your playing is your repertoire, the songs that you choose to play. And you have a really diverse repertoire, and you play a lot of old pop songs that many people don't know or have forgotten, as well as some songs that are like novelty songs, like, you know, Tootsie and I'm an Old Cowhand, and Noel Coward songs. Are these a lot of these songs you grew up with?
Yeah, a lot of them are songs that I heard when I was a youngster. When I was growing up, the big thing to do every week was go to the movies on Saturday. And on Saturday, we used to see a lot of these movies that had this scores in it, you know, by some of the composers. And we'd see Louis Armstrong and pictures and different musical personalities that I enjoyed a lot. Of course, I also heard music around the house and so on, but the movies did provide a certain large part, I think, of some of the things that I play today, you know.
When you started performing, was it hard to find other musicians who liked the same songs you did and who wanted to play them? I mean, even back in the days when you were playing with Miles Davis or with Clifford Brown, did they share your musical taste?
I would say, basically, yes. People like Coltrane and Clifford Brown, we all had an appreciation of what they would call today the standard songs. It is, in my case, I might have found some more obscure songs.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, like, propose playing something like Tootsie and have other musicians look at you like you were crazy?
Well, they might have thought so, but they wouldn't dare to say it.
Well, why don't we pause here?
It was my gig, you know.
Right, right. Well, why don't we pause here and play your recording of There's No Business Like Show Business? I love what you do with it. This is Sonny Rollins. There's No Business Like Show Business. Sonny Rollins, recorded in 1955. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back to more of our 1994 interview with Sonny Rollins. You grew up in Harlem, in New York, and your parents, I believe both of your parents, were from the Virgin Islands?
That's right.
What were your parents' ambitions for you? Did they push you to excel when you were young?
Yeah, well, I was the youngest child. I have an older brother who was a very fine classical violinist. He ended up being a physician. Then I had an older sister who was also sang a lot in church and everything. And so I was supposed to follow in their footsteps. Of course, I didn't because I was somewhat of a black sheep. They were much more studious than I. And I wanted to hang out and play ball. And as the years went on, I was really the guy that was out going to jazz clubs and all that. These things were frowned on at that time.
The jazz life, when you started to play, actually had a lot of heroin involved with it.
Right.
And you got involved with that for a while when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you would have tried something like that if it weren't for it being such a part of the jazz world in the 50s?
I don't think I would have actually. There would really have been no reason, I don't think, to get involved with that. I got involved with it because a lot of my idols were doing it and so on. So we thought that using drugs was sort of the thing to do. But this is something like asking whether Billie Holiday would be the singer she is if she didn't use drugs. I've had this discussion often with people. And my answer is that, yes, I think Billie Holiday would be the singer she is regardless of what happened to her. I mean, even though she may sing about hard times and all that, she was a consummate musician and beautiful singer. So, yes, I think that she would sing the way she did. Charlie Parker would play the way he did. Everybody would do what they did.
It must have been your parents' worst nightmare when you entered the jazz world and then started using.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my mother was pretty, since I was a baby, my mother really, she stuck by me regardless of what I did. She was really in my corner, but I had a lot of problems from the rest of my family. My father, my grandmother, they really were pretty down on me. And my siblings, they didn't really understand where I was coming from anyway. But I have to say that my mother really believed in me all the way. And I'm really happy that I was able to get myself together before she left the scene. So she kind of saw me start to make records and so on like that. So I sort of made her feel that her trust wasn't exactly all in vain, you know.
Were you ever arrested?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was arrested. Unfortunately, I had to get involved with the justice system and all of this stuff, you know. But I was always lucky because I was able to get involved with music programs.
In the prison?
Right. And in those days, there were other musicians there, you know, so.
Did it scare you when you were in prison? Did you say to yourself, like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it scared me a lot. It scared me a lot. But again, I was lucky because I could play an instrument, and
right.
and a lot of the other prisoners knew of me, so I immediately had respect from them.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, being locked up is no joyride.
How did you straighten out?
Well, it took a little while, but you know, I slid back a couple of times and everything. But I eventually had gotten down to the complete bottom. So I couldn't have gotten any worse, you know. I mean, I was really in a complete.
What was the bottom?
Well, the bottom was sleeping in parked cars and in garages and all that stuff, you know, and what we used to call in those days carrying the stick. Carrying the stick meant that you were homeless. I guess today they would just say, "Guy's homeless." But I did this mainly when I was in Chicago. Chicago was where I was sort of was out there on my own. In New York, even though I was persona non grata at home, I could always perhaps get by or sneak in the house or something. But when I was really away from home, I really had to pay a lot of dues, as we used to say.
How would you protect your horn during the periods when you were homeless?
Well, I didn't protect my horn. I mean, I didn't have a horn, really.
Were you borrowing other people's horns?
I was borrowing other people's horns, yeah.
What did you learn about yourself during that period?
Well, what I learned about myself? Well, I learned that I had the strength to get over something, which was really deep. And I think one of the things that I always feel good about myself was that I was able to overcome that, because I really had to struggle. You know, when I came away from the hospital one time and I went back to the nightclub, it was really the classic scene of the old drug pushers standing there saying, "Come on, man, come on, you know, and this is good." And I really went through the classic scene of fighting myself, you know, saying, "Well, gee, if I go with them, it wouldn't be so bad. It's just one time, and maybe I should do it, and why not?" And this, and then that's the other part of me saying, "No, don't do it." You know, I mean, the real classic battle between good and evil, right and wrong, whatever you want to call it.
Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins is my guest. Over the years, you've taken several hiatuses. There have been several periods where you haven't performed, and I think one period like that lasted, was it 5 years? Was that the longest?
It's hard to say. I took a hiatus on the bridge, which was pretty well documented.
Right, this was during the period when you were practicing on the Williamsburg Bridge in New York, because it was too loud for you to practice in your apartment.
Right.
So, but what were some of the reasons that have led you during different times of your career away from performing?
Well, there was also a period when I ran into a lot of difficulty with the powers that be in the music business. I mean, I was looked upon as sort of a person that was hard to get along with. Somehow I got that reputation, I guess, because I tried to demand a certain amount of money or I didn't want to be messed around like a lot of guys or whatever. But I've always dealt with that during my whole career in one way or another.
So when you take a hiatus, when do you know it's time to get back to performing?
Well, when I took my hiatus on the bridge, it became apparent because I had sort of gotten what I wanted to do. I was trying to really accomplish something musically, and I'd sort of gotten close enough to what I was doing that I felt if I stayed there, it might have turned into a self-indulgence, and that's not what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd sort of gotten to that point when I realized, well, it's time to come back. I didn't accomplish everything that I wanted to, but I felt I accomplished enough that I proved the point to myself.
I'd love to know what it feels like to play your horn on the Williamsburg Bridge. And this was the period when you weren't performing, but you were practicing a lot on the bridge, I guess in the middle of the night?
Well, yeah, we played in the night and in the daytime anytime. It was actually a beautiful place to play because it was a nice space up there. You were really on top of the subway. The trains that came across the bridge were underneath you.
You were on the pedestrian walk?
Yeah, the pedestrian walk. So it's really a nice space up there, and you're sort of right in the middle of everything. You can see the Manhattan and on the other side Brooklyn, and the boats would be coming by at night, and you could blow as loud as you want, and nobody would even look at you. You know, every now and then people would walk by, but nobody would even look. You know, I mean, this was the sophistication of New Yorkers.
Yeah, New Yorkers are immune to everything. do you think your sound got bigger during that period?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it did have certain good effects, really.
Do you feel that you're living the life that you're supposed to be living now? You know, performing when you want to perform, living in the country in New York with also an apartment in Manhattan. I mean, do you feel that you've designed the right life for yourself?
Yeah, I feel I've designed the right life for myself. However, as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to feel that I want to perform more. You know, as Count Basie said, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon now for me. So it's a lot of time now when I might be off for 6 weeks or so. And I'm beginning to feel now that I'd like to be playing a little more because there's less time. Let me put it that way. There's less time for me to do everything that I want to do.
You feel you're getting older and you want to get in as much as you can.
As much as I can.
Yeah.
So I have to sort of temper my strategy a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing that you'll be performing more is actually very good news. So I'm really glad to hear that. It's just been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been wanting to talk with you on the show for so long.
Thanks, Sarah, so
much for doing it. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Sonny Rollins recorded in 1994. He has a new double CD retrospective of his 25 years with Milestone Records called Silver City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Next Generation crew is back in space in the new Star Trek movie that opened today. Coming up, we look back at the original Star Trek with William Shatner. And we hear from Jeff Bridges, who's now co-starring with Barbra Streisand in The Mirror Has Two Faces. Also, reviews of the TV remake of In Cold Blood and the new film Breaking the Waves. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's account of a Midwestern murder spree shocked people as both a book and a movie in the mid-60s. 3 decades later, this Sunday and Tuesday nights, CBS presents the new 4-hour miniseries In Cold Blood, starring Anthony Edwards of ER and Eric Roberts as the killers. TV critic Diva Bianculli has a review.
In 1959, two ex-convicts drove hundreds of miles to a Kansas farm, intending to steal thousands of dollars they heard was hidden in a safe. Their information, from a fellow prisoner named Floyd, was no good. But as they headed for the farm, Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, played in this miniseries by Roberts and Edwards, didn't know that.
There's going to be him, her, the kid, and a girl.
A girl. How old is the girl?
Sweet 16, sugar. Pretty as a fresh picked flower, as the boy says. Nancy Clutter. Kind of kid makes a boy's heart kind of hurry, is what he said.
You're not a boy, Dick.
Okay. Let's see. It's Saturday. So the two older girls, two women, sisters, might be visiting. They're married, I think. Some may say, 8. In my company, 12. The only sure thing is no witnesses, right? Ain't that what I promised you, honey? No witnesses. Plenty of hair on them walls.
Hickok was wrong about the money, but right about the brutality. When Smith and Hickok got to the farm that cold night in November, there was no safe and no hidden stash of cash. When they left the farm, the man and woman who owned it and their two teen children were dead, victims of a shockingly brutal and senseless multiple murder. Truman Capote spent years researching the case and interviewing both the killers and the people in Kansas who knew the victims. By the time he sat down to write In Cold Blood, he had decided to tell two stories at the same time. One was of the two ex-cons and how they got together and planned their crime. The other was of the Clutter family, describing their everyday lives and relationships. At one terrible moment in the novel, those two stories intersect, and the rest of the book tells how the criminals were caught, tried, and executed. Capote's book is so good, and its structure so powerful, that Hollywood hasn't messed with it much. In 1967, Richard Brooks wrote and directed a strong movie version, starring Robert Blake as Perry Smith, the more sensitive and unstable of the two killers. The movie, intercut between the villains and their eventual victims, then literally cut to the chase, to the part where police are investigating the murder and looking for suspects. The dramatization of the actual murders was held for the flashback at the climax. This expanded CBS version, written by Benedict Fitzgerald and directed by Jonathan Kaplan, takes the exact same approach. The only real difference is the length, which allows for more character development, especially of the victims and investigators. But even though this new In Cold Blood lets us know the victims a little better, it doesn't do the same for the killers. The performances by Edwards and Roberts and the scenes they're given to play aren't as good or as revealing as the ones in the original movie. I understand why In Cold Blood was ripe for a remake. When the murders took place, and even when Capote's book came out, that sort of awful brutality was so unusual it was shocking. Today we're a lot more familiar with the face of evil, and are perhaps even more willing to confront and understand it. What I don't understand, this time around, is why In Cold Blood was remade this tamely, and this poorly.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The Next Generation crew is back in space, battling more lethal enemies in the new film Star Trek First Contact. On this archive edition, we have a 1993 interview with the original Captain Kirk, William Shatner. He didn't work on the new movie, but he's still playing off the Star Trek phenomenon. He's now at work on his third Star Trek novel. I spoke with him after the publication of his book Star Trek Memories. I asked him to share some memories, starting with how they used to get beamed up.
First of all, beaming up was a device, a dramatic device, so that you didn't have to have a gangplank go down and
or an elevator or some or a shuttle to go from the ship to the shore. So the it was an invention of convenience, and it really is just a dissolve. Two blank pieces of film dissolved together with a little spritz in it on the film, a little sparkling, and it's a very simple special effects, long since thought of as primitive.
What did you have to do to make it work so that the effect would be convincing?
We would stand in the on these plates of glass that had lights underneath them, and the lights would go up and down. The camera's rolling. The camera continues to roll, and we walk off. They then film the blank, the empty space with the lights going up and down. And what they do in the post-production is cut out our walking off and dissolve the film. The camera has stayed locked off. The camera has not moved and continues to roll. And dissolve the piece of film that has us in standing on the plates of glass and the empty plates of glass that we're standing on. And the dissolve is either, if we arrive, is from the empty to the people standing in it, or from people standing in it to the empty if we're leaving. It's very simple, with a little scratching on the little sparkling.
So for you as the actor, it was like, stand here for a few seconds.
Right. And in the first several months of filming, we didn't quite understand that the walking off was not going to be there no matter what we did. We could run, walk, crawl off. It was not going to be there. So we kind of walked off in character, you know, as though this was meaningful. It became hysterical to us months later, as we began to realize the techniques that the simplistic techniques that were involved that required not much intelligence to understand, we thought were highly complicated. Something was happening we didn't understand. Well, we better be in character all the time.
Now, I seem to remember lots of episodes in which Captain Kirk would go to another planet where a lonely, horny woman would try to kidnap him and keep him for her own.
Yes.
Have I exaggerated the number of episodes like this over the years?
Yeah, not in my opinion. It's all I can remember. The whole thing is fading from view except those beautiful girls.
So did the romantic episodes go over well?
Oh, my God, I look forward to them each week. Who's the girl this week? Who did you bring me this week, said the king. You
know? What are some of the get-ups that
brief costumes. Again, Bill Tice came to my rescue and made those girls as naked as possible, basically because we couldn't afford too much wardrobe, so the less material he had to use, the better, and that was part of it. You know, he'd get some expensive crepe or organdy and use as little of it as possible. You know, a little drape here and a little handful there, and it was enough. It was as risque as television got in those days, and unfortunately I was the recipient of all that risqueness?
Risqueability, who knows? Mm. When Star Trek really took off in syndication, did you feel vindicated and think, I knew it all along, this is a great show? Mm. Or did you look at its success and think, I just don't get it?
Well, I was removed from it because in those years, residuals stopped after 5 replays. Well, by the time it got to syndication, it replayed 5 times somewhere. So we, the actors, never received any money from the fact that it played innumerable times over the years. Some of the bitterness that may still reside in some of the actors is as a result that their faces have become extremely well known, but they haven't been compensated commensurately.
But what did you think of the show's success?
I was astonished. Who would have thought that a show, it was just a phenomenon.
I mean, did you feel vindicated? Did you feel
it was more, I don't get it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't vindicated by any means. I thought it had its natural life, you know. We struggled against odds and made something work for 3 years. Again, in itself, was unusual.
William Shatner? I'm going to play a record.
You what?
Do you know what's coming?
I have no idea.
Okay, here it comes. This is you.
picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
William Shatner, this record has become a kind of a camp favorite over the years.
So it seems.
Yeah, what's the story behind how you made this record? Whose idea was it? What was the idea behind it?
Well, it was a concept record, and
the album was called The Transformed Man.
Right, and what I had attempted to do there was combine speech and song so that there are excerpts from classical plays that precedes that cut. Now, Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds was LSD. And I don't quite remember the cut that precedes. I think it's Cyrano de Bergerac with the speech that ends, I may climb to no great heights, but I will climb alone, that had original music written to it. So it in effect, were lyrics to a song, to a musical theme. Segues into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which is a drug song of a person who can't climb alone. So the idea was amorphous, perhaps, but it was an honorable idea. What's happened is nobody plays the cut that precedes it. They play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Although listening to that, if you were to take a drug song and if you were to visualize colors and kaleidoscopes, you might have some fun thinking of a new interpretation of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
So you still like it?
I listened to that little cut. I didn't mind that. My voice is a tenor there. That's a long time ago.
Sometimes I put on the TV on Saturday afternoon when they have their like monster horror chiller theater type show on, and you're there battling the spiders.
Yeah, another cult favorite. I have become a cult favorite over the years for one or another of things I've done. I've got to get into the straight world soon.
William Shatner, recorded in 1993. Coming up, Jeff Bridges. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Bridges is now co-starring with Barbra Streisand in The Mirror Has Two Faces. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Bridges recorded after the release of his film American Heart. Jeff Bridges is the leading man of the family. His brother is character actor Beau Bridges. Their father, Lloyd Bridges, spent a lot of time underwater filming the TV series Sea Hunt when the boys were growing up. Jeff starred with his brother in The Fabulous Baker Boys and worked with his father in Tucker. Jeff Bridges' other films include The Last Picture Show, Jagged Edge, Against All Odds, The Fisher King, American Heart, and Fearless. Our interview was recorded in 1993. I'm about your age. I think I'm a year younger than you are. So, like a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of people, I grew up watching Sea Hunt, right?
That's right.
I grew up living in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, but I knew how to prevent getting the bends.
Very good.
Yeah, like this is going to be real useful information to me.
can you hum the Sea Hunt theme?
Gosh, you know, I don't think I can. Can you? Go ahead.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Something like that. I got to get off there at the end.
Now, were your friends, did they watch the show, and did that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah, sure. They watched the show. A lot of them liked it. You know, occasionally I would get the, you think you're so great, you're Mike Nelson's kid. Yeah, you think you're real great, don't you? You know, I get some of that. But all in all, it was, you know, the kids pretty much dug it, I thought.
You were on some episodes when you were a kid. How old
yeah.
were you, and what were the scenes? What did you have to do?
Oh, I was about, I think on the first one, maybe about 9 years old. I remember being trapped in a cave, and Mike Nelson had to to dive under there and get me, and my girlfriend of the time, my neighbor, Andy Kaplan, was playing my my partner in that one. And my my dad, Mike Nelson, had to swim under there and save us. And I remember telling my girlfriend, I said, well, maybe if we sing, they'll hear us and they'll save us. And I had to sing a song.
Underwater? Oh, this was an underwater cave. This was a regular cave.
It's like, you know, the tide is rising, you know, and trapped us in this cave.
Of course, of course.
I remember being thrown off Malibu Pier in the middle of winter and, you know, having to say my lines with the cold water, you know, that sort of thing.
Let me ask you, your brother Beau Bridges was 9 years older than you. Did he ever have to take care of you when you were young? And did you, like, tag along with him and his friends against his will?
Being 8 years older, it was almost, a lot of times it was a kind of an uncle, you know, nephew relationship almost.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have the typical kind of competition, really. He, you know, I looked up to him, and he was always so great in sports. He was scouted by the Dodgers, you know, and he was on the UCLA basketball team. And for a guy who is, you know, I think he's about 5'10 or 11, you know, he was playing out there with Walt Hazard and all those guys. And, you know, he taught me how to do all those sports and box and everything. So he was, you know, yeah, I really did look up to him. He really was my hero. And then he taught me how to act, and we would do, we used to do this thing, this idea we came up with where, you know, so often you talk to actors and they say, you know, it's tough because we need an audience, you know, and there's no audience. You can't just act in your room by yourself. That's not gratifying at all. So what Beau and I would do is we'd rent a flatbed truck, and we would play the supermarket circuit. We would get a few scenes together, and we would go into a supermarket parking lot, and we would get on the back of the flatbed truck, and we would act, and we would get people to all come around and watch our show and improvise and do kind of crazy things until the cops would come, and then we'd try to include the cops in the show, and they would kind of get flustered, and then one of us would get in the driver's seat and drive off to the next supermarket.
So it's kind of a strange thing to do, pull up a flatbed truck to a supermarket parking lot and put on a little show. What did people make of it?
I don't know. You know, sometimes we would start it with a fight. You know, my father taught us how to fake fight, you know, do stage fighting. So sometimes we would start with a fight, you know, to get people saying, what's happening? Get a crowd around us. And then we would say, we're just kidding. We're going to put on a show. And then they'd gather around. It's a good idea. I recommend it highly for all you actors out there who need an audience.
Now, one of your early films was the remake of King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Did it turn out like you expected?
Oh, not really. You know, I was a big fan of the original. I remember, you know, faking sick just to get out of school to see that thing. You know, I love that original movie.
Me too.
And it worked all right. I mean, it was tough. It's a tough acting assignment to have to do all that, you know, with all the technical stuff, because that the acting kind of takes a back seat to that.
Did you have to do a lot of scenes in which there was a mechanical ape arm playing opposite you?
I did a few of those, but I remember being on the set when Jessica Lange was in this hand, and God, the camera should have been turned the other way, because I've never had this feeling, a combination of horror and laughing my head off, seeing the director, who was this English guy, directing these five Italians. Each man had a finger on this giant, had a control that controlled the finger of this huge gorilla paw. And Jesse was in this paw, and he finally, you know, he couldn't communicate with these guys in words, so he finally said, just look at my bloody hand. And he stuck his hand up in the air. He had all these five Italian guys looking at his hand, trying to, you know, figure out how much he should squeeze the fingers. And Jessica almost got crushed several times. I mean, you know, it was very painful for her. Terrible situation.
Jeff Bridges recorded in 1993. In his film The Fabulous Baker Boys, he starred opposite Michelle Pfeiffer, who has a new romantic comedy coming out called One Fine Day. Here she is singing Makin' Whoopee from the soundtrack of The Fabulous Baker Boys.
A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. The groom is nervous, he answers twice. It's really killing that he's so willing to make whoopee. Picture a little love nest down where the roses cling. Sweet love nest. Think what a year can bring. He's washing dishes and baby clothes. He's so ambitious, even so. But don't forget folks. You get folks for making whoopee. For making whoopee.
Coming up, a review of the new film Breaking the Waves. This is Fresh Air. Two big films at this year's Cannes Film Festival were Secrets and Lies and Breaking the Waves, an arty film about religion and faith. It was shot in Scotland by a Danish director and stars newcomer Emily Watson. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Orson Welles once remarked that there were two things he never believed when he saw them on screen: people making love and people praying. I can only imagine what he'd say about the brilliant and exasperating new film Breaking the Waves. It's about lovemaking and prayer. Emily Watson stars as Bess, a not-so-bright innocent who lives in an isolated Scottish community whose citizens are fanatically Calvinist. Although deeply devout, Bess adores her husband Jan, an outsider who teaches her the pleasures of the world. When Jan's suddenly paralyzed in an oil rig accident, he asks her to sleep with other men and then tell him about it, to give him a reason to live. Because she's a genuinely good woman, and more than a little unbalanced, Bess makes this sacrifice for him, and her life becomes a sexual Calvary. She's torn apart by the contradiction between the strict religious ideas she's internalized and the spiritual promptings of her own heart. This inner conflict takes its most striking form in a series of ongoing dialogues with God, conversations in which Bess does both voices.
I thank you for the greatest gift of all. The gift of love. I thank you for Jan. I'm so lucky to have been given these gifts.
But remember to be a good girl, Bess. For you know I giveth and I taketh away.
What? I didn't mean it like that. Yes. I'll be good. I'll be really, really good.
Breaking the Waves is the first English-language film by Lars von Trier, the Danish director best known in the States for Zentropa. Von Trier is notorious for being snide and egregiously arty, but here he's in dead earnest. This is a movie shot through with headlong emotion. There's passion in the ferociously jagged camera work of photographer Robi Müller, and there's passion in the actors, especially Emily Watson, whose screen debut as Bess is nothing short of emotionally overwhelming. Whether she's beaming with mad glee, trembling with sexual desire for Jan, or imploring her church elders for mercy, Watson gives us a wrenching portrait of a woman whose capacity for love is indistinguishable from self-annihilation. Yet even as it sucks us into its emotional whirlpool, Breaking the Waves also deliberately pushes us away. Von Trier breaks Bess's story into chapters, each introduced by a beautiful, slowly changing image of an idyllic scene that comes accompanied by a kitschy pop song like A Whiter Shade of Pale. These chapter breaks cool us down. They make us think when we want to keep feeling. Of course, sainthood stories are invariably fraught with violence and masochism. Sanctity demands suffering, after all. And Breaking the Waves is not an easy or pleasant film. It tends to divide viewers between those who find it a shattering masterpiece and those who just hate watching Bess be slowly ground to dust, violated by her lovers, reviled by her neighbors. In fact, Breaking the Waves is neither so good nor so bad as most people are saying. Although it has harrowing power and is clearly one of this year's best films, it's not in the same league as the greatest religious films, such as Carl Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc or Robert Bresson's Mouchette. The problem is that for all the misery he shows us, von Trier ultimately makes everything too easy. For most of the film, we wonder whether Bess really is a kind of modern saint, or whether she's merely a pathetic victim of a repressive community and her own romantic mania. But in the closing scenes, von Trier makes the answer perfectly clear. The movie loses its spiritual ambiguity, and it starts to feel schematic and slightly pat, as if the deck has been stacked from the beginning. Whereas Dreyer and Bresson knew that the workings of God's grace is mysterious and eludes the grasp of mere mortals, von Trier denies such mystery by showing us the explicit meaning of Bess's story. He makes the mistake of thinking that he can speak for God, which is surely vanity in a filmmaker who's just found religion.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.